Welcome to The Point. I'm Jeanette Barnes, in for Mindy Todd. Today, it's our monthly book show. Humor is something many of us could use a little more of in our lives. I know I could. Today, we are talking about funny books. With us, retired reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hi, Jill.
Good morning.
And Jane Iafrady, past chair of Falmouth Reads Together and an obituary writer for the Enterprise newspapers. Hi, Jane.
Hi, great to be here.
Jane, why don't you start us off?
I will. And let me just start by saying I am so thrilled to be reunited professionally with the great Gilda Geist, our host, our morning edition host this morning.
All right, excellent.
Former Enterprise writer. So when I think about writers who I think are just devastatingly funny, the first person I think of is Florence King. Now, Florence King, the book that I'd like to discuss briefly is The Florence King Reader, which is a compilation of her writing from the mid-1950s through the 1990s. So Florence King was a political writer for many years, most well known for her regular columns in the National Review and her memoir, Confessions of a Failed Southern Lady. She was a bisexual, conservative Southern woman. So,
which seems sort of impossible.
Maybe these days.
It's pretty impressive.
But back in the day, she was able to pull that off. She has an incredible body of work, and it's in this collection. It's everything from newspaper articles to political columns to a very much failed bodice ripper called The Barbarian Princess. And in fact, one of the funniest pieces in this collection is the introduction where she recreates a discussion between her publisher and herself about how intellectually challenging the book should be, because she comes from a place where everything is intellectually challenging, and he's like, no, this is like beach reading. Don't you can't use the word barbarian. Nobody knows what a barbarian is. Things like that. It's hilarious. So I would just like to read a quick piece from the prologue to Confessions of a Failed Southern Lady. If you wish to understand the American woman, study the Southern woman. The sweetening process the feminists call socialization is simply a less intense version of what goes on in every Southern family. We call it rearing. One of my prerequisites for this is I had to be like almost not be able to get through the reading. So if the rearing is successful, results in that perfection of femininity are known as a lady. I was reared. My granny worked so hard at my rearing. She was a frustrated ladysmith, and I was her last chance. Mama had defeated her, but she kept the anvil hot for me and began hammering and firing with a strength born of desperation from the day I entered the world to the day I left it. This was one of my years on her anvil. This story is of my years of her on her anvil. Whether she succeeded in making a lady out of me is for you to decide, but I will say one thing in my own favor before we begin. No matter what sex I went to bed with, I never smoked on the street. She is my all-time favorite.
Okay. Jill.
All right. Well, I brought a few. One of the things I thought of first about when we got together about doing this was comic books. Comic books having been a big part of my life as a child, and the comics in newspapers that I used to read every day. And one of those comics that I love very much was the Peanuts comics. And what I did not know was that they were being written way before I arrived in the world. And this, I have one volume, the complete Peanuts has been, all of the cartoons have come out. This one happens to be 1950 to 1952. The definitive collection of Charles M. Schwartz's comic strip masterpiece, as it says on the front of the book. And what, as I was looking through this, I was like, well, of course, it's very hard to describe what the characters look like in a comic, but often they're so funny, you don't really need the illustrations themselves. But the other extraordinary thing about this book for me was that none of them looked the same as they did when I was, clearly, this was an early Charlie Brown, and they're all much younger than they were when I saw them. And I had no clue that he had actually aged his characters somewhat, or for whatever reason, they definitely don't, or this is just the early version, and then gradually he turned them into looking something
else. Yes, it's interesting how you can see a lot of times if you look at cartoons over time how the way the artist drew it evolved, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that
whether or not the characters age.
That's right. That is right. So I've just pulled out a couple that happened to be book related. And here's one of them. And this is Charlie Brown and Schroeder. And he says, now on the very next day, and then one of the characters comes over. I don't even know which character this is because they don't give her a name. And I don't think it's not Lucy, but in any case, she says, what are you men reading? Fairy tales? And Charlie says, Schroeder's not interested in fairy tales. This is the life of Beethoven. And as we all know, Schroeder grew up to be a great pianist. There's another one here. One of the kids, and I think it's Schroeder, comes up. Yes, it is Schroeder. And he says to Charlie Brown, read. And Charlie Brown says, okay, Schroeder, climb up in the chair. And he opens the book, and the first thing Charlie Brown reads is, printed in USA, designed and produced and copyrighted 1951. And there's a big question mark over Schroeder's head, and Charlie Brown says, application for second-class entry applied for at the post office at New York, New York, at which point there's just ZZZ over Schroeder's head. So it's hard, needless to say, to get the full effect of cartoons when you're hearing them rather than seeing them, because clearly the illustrations are as essential, if not more essential, than in the books. However, that has not stopped me because I brought a couple of other books that have come. This is the comic part of the show. And I had to bring something by Roz Chast.
Yay.
And I was going to say, my co-book talker here this morning is also a big fan of Roz Chast. And any of you that subscribe to The New Yorker would certainly have seen her work. And I still love Roz Chast, but this is an ancient piece of book that I have found in the house when I was looking for things. This came out in 1985. It's called Poems and Songs by Roz Chast. And I was delighted, because I haven't looked at this book in a long time, delighted to see that she had actually, I signed the book, and it was a limited edition, which was lovely. But even more lovely, I happened to find a postcard in here which said, Dear Jill Erickson, thanks for your appreciation and letter. Have a happy 86. Best, Roz Chast. So that was very exciting to find. But the book itself is really a lovely, and all of her, I mean, I see Jane has one sitting in front of her, so we'll get to that in a moment. But here's the first illustration and what it says. And this is actually, again, with her drawings, you want to see them, but she also has some very funny text. This one is called The Potato. Potato, potato, a vegetable so wise, so humble and sincere, a diamond in disguise. Some call him Little Tater, some call him Mighty Joe, but there's really nothing greater than this gem from Idaho. It's ridiculous. But again, as with all humor, some of it will engage you and some of it won't. But on the top of my funny list is Roz Chast. And would you like to say a word about that book have in front of you?
Absolutely. So I am a huge fan of Roz Chast. Read a lot of her work. And I think what's interesting between Poems and Songs, which Jill just discussed, and the book that I brought, which is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, is the evolution
of
her work. Quite a leap. This is much more recent. Jill's is an the one that Jill brought is an earlier Roz Chast. So can't we talk about something more pleasant? Is about the most unlikely humorous topic, which is helping your aging parents deal with the breakdowns of their homes and their bodies and their minds and trying to move them into the next stages of their life. This, I have to say, this is a book that I have given to so many friends because after I read it, I felt like, okay, somebody else understands this issue of working with your elderly parents in the most loving ways that you can, but it's somebody else understands it's a challenge. So I just want to read one panel from the book, which is she's trying to convince her mom to go to the doctor, to go to the hospital for a medical issue. This is the narration. My mother had a strong aversion to doctors and hospitals. It didn't surprise me that she didn't want to call in the cavalry. This is mom speaking. Doctors! They have a God complex. They tell you to do something, and then a month later, it's never do that thing. Some people think doctors walk on water, but not me. And hospitals, don't get me started. Here's what I think about hospitals. That's where you go to die, capital letters. My body wants to be well. I'm a Jewish Christian Scientist. And that's just a very small taste of what this entire text is about. It's very kind of Brooklyn and Jewish and you know, crazy parents and a doting daughter who tries her best but is exasperated at almost every point.
And wasn't that part of the townwide read at one point?
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me. This was the townwide read several years ago. We had the Atul Gawande Being Mortal, and this was one of the companion pieces to that.
That's so interesting, too, about the range of humor. You know, some of it is very light and fun, and some of it is really kind of like working hard to comfort us in a way and make us understand subjects that actually are really difficult. So, and I'm so happy that both of you brought multiple books that really either are comics or focus on illustration, because that's great, too. Jill, do you have another one for us?
I've got one more comic book, which is somebody else who is, even now, still every once in a while you see one of his cartoons in The New Yorker. This is a guy named Glenn Baxter, who he's been around for a very long time, but he's another guy that, like, you just, another cartoonist who you don't hear that much about. This, however, is called Almost Completely Baxter, New and Selected Blurtings by Glenn Baxter. And they are, once again, sort of difficult to explain because the illustrations, more than anything in these cartoon narratives, are really just so fabulous that you can't really describe them. But this should urge you to go out and look for some Glenn Baxter. I will give you a few of he has certain pieces that he does sort of over and over and does different illustrations with the same words. And one of them is Great Failures of Our Time. And so he will have an illustration having to do with great failures of our time. In this one, it's number 77, First Dental Extraction by Red Admiral. And it's this fellow sitting in a chair who has a string coming out of his mouth, but what's holding on to the end of the string is a butterfly. And you can see how that might not work with the end, that therefore it would be a great failure of our time. There's another one that's Great Failures of Our Time, number 224, the first Frankfurter. And in this case, the Frankfurter is like rolled up. It's not one long thing. It's just rolled up. Again, you have to look at the pictures. So I would highly recommend Baxter, and he has, I know there have been more books than just this one, but I think this is the most recent one. And here's one more. From her room, Gladys saw very little of the splendors of Venice, and her window in this room is about the size of a peanut, and she's trying to look at Venice. So it's completely black around this little bit of light coming through her door. So, again, this is very special humor, and I find it incredibly funny, but not everyone will. But you know what? I think that's true of all comedy. That, and as we have prepped for this show, the comedy changes dramatically from the very long ago and the present, and it's seems to be changing faster and faster, mm-hmm. as what with the internet and everyone having a TikTok page, things change.
Okay, remind us of the title of that one again for listeners.
It is called Almost Completely Baxter, New and Selected Blurtings by Glenn Baxter.
Okay, and I just wanted to run over again some of those other titles in case listeners missed that, and we're hoping to pick up those books. We went over The Florence King Reader by Florence King, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant by Roz Chast, The Complete Peanuts by Charles Schulz, and Poems and Songs by Roz Chast. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book that has made you laugh or just kind of smile with the ironic humor of the whole thing. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we will have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show, and our theme this month is funny books. With us are retired reference librarian Jill Erickson and Jane Iafredi, past chair of Falmouth Reads Together. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jane, what do you have for us next?
So next, I'd like to discuss, riffing on Jill's last comment about how comedy has changed over the years, is All About Me, which is an autobiography by the great Mel Brooks. I have a bad habit of saying that this is like the best of the best all the time. And, you know, every book is the best of the best and every movie is the best of the best. But Mel Brooks is the best of the best, let me tell you. So this autobiography, which was published in 2021, takes readers through Mel Brooks's career as a comedian, a writer, and a director of some of the greatest comedy films ever done. And one of my absolute favorites, and I can quote the dialogue from almost every Mel Brooks movie. But one of the best of the best, in my opinion, is History of the World Part One. And so in his autobiography, Brooks takes us through every project that he's done. Every chapter is a project. And he has this great chapter about History of the World. He just tells a number of great stories. And the stories are great, not just because they're funny, but because he is so generous in the credit that he gives to the people who are working around him for some of these great comedy bits that are in these movies. And so he's describing the French Revolution part of History of the World, which essentially stars Harvey Korman, who a lot of people know from the old Carol Burnett show, and Mel Brooks. And Mel Brooks is the king, and Harvey Korman is the Count de Monet, which is always mispronounced as Count the Money. it's just a shtick that keeps going throughout this scene. And anyways, Mel Brooks is also playing. A lot of this is not safe for radio, so I have to, you know, kind of recraft some of the language here. He plays a boy who takes a bucket around so that men can relieve themselves. Sort of early urine diversion in the French Revolution. And Mel Brooks is playing that part as well. And so Count de Monet, after he relieves himself, goes up to the king and says, "You bear a striking resemblance to," I'll call, "the urine diversion boy." And before filming had started, Harvey Korman very famously said to Mel Brooks, "I never break character when I'm filming. On TV, I break character all the time." If you've ever seen any episode of The Carol Burnett Show, you know this. breaking all the time. But he says, in movies, never, because it costs so much more to reshoot for film. And so Mel Brooks decides he's going to test that in this scene. And so Harvey Korman goes up to Mel Brooks and says, you bear a striking resemblance to the urine boy. And Mel Brooks says, well, you look like a bucket of excrement. And Harvey Korman just loses it. And Mel Brooks is so pleased with himself that he was able to do this. And, of course, they reshoot the scene and Korman doesn't break. And the film goes off with the rest of the scene. Anyways, every chapter is written with all of these crazy little tidbits. And if you like anything about Mel Brooks, this is worth reading because, it's sort of a loving homage to all of the people that he worked with, including the great late Anne Bancroft, who was his wife. And there's a couple of really lovely chapters about her as well.
That's All About Me by Mel Brooks. And I know that he was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross talking around the same time that book came out in 2021. That was a cool thing. I found that online last night getting ready for this show. Right now, we have Charlene on the phone from Falmouth. Charlene, let's hear about your funny book.
Good morning. Humor is what gets me through the day. And so listening to these wonderful selections is perfect. And Jane, hi Jane.
Hello.
Your comments about the Southern book. Well, I grew up in the South, and this is the way we talked. So it is nothing new. It remains funny. But I think that one of the book series that could be included in this collection are books by Rita Mae Brown.
And oh, yes.
That is something that everybody needs to sort of meet at some point and just sit down and be ready to laugh and cry and enjoy.
Yes.
I can't believe I forgot about Rita Mae Brown. She is so great.
Indeed. So enjoy, keep laughing, and keep reading.
Great. Thank you, Charlene. Right. Jill, what is next?
Okay, so we've moved on from the comic books and the comics. And I have now Kiss and Tell by Alain de Botton. And he has written a lot of books about a lot of things. And this is one of his early books. And here's how the Publishers Weekly's review began. Quote, dental work on. Quote, first kiss and new hairstyle can all be found under the index entries for Isabel Rogers, the charming, unsuspecting subject of this diverting fictional biography. De Botton plays a nimble game through the eyes and idiosyncrasies of his smart, pretentious narrator, looking for an opportunity to explore the nature of biography without being overshadowed by his subject. The narrator attaches himself to a woman he thinks will be mundane enough to be fully mastered. And one of the things that I have to say I most love about this book is it has an index. It's fiction. It's completely fiction, but it's pretending to be a memoir, you know, nonfiction here. And so there's this really funny index in the back. And if any of you that have listened to the show for any length of time know, I really, really love good indexes, which are very hard to come by these days because computers are doing them, but this one he clearly did. And so you can get a sense of what he has, what he's going to be talking about in here, what books. He has things like insults, comma, self-inflicted, comma, pages 1 to 2. Then there's lonely hearts columns, pages 229 to 33, and so forth and so on. But I love the whole idea of taking a novel and giving it an index because nobody does that. So that's, or nobody I've ever read before. And so he is writing this biography of this woman who has just met, but he's very fascinated by biographies in general. And here is some of what he's written about biographers. Signs of the independent life of biographers are disappointingly scarce. At the end of the acknowledgments, a coy hint occasionally protrudes. One may be fortunate enough to find the place or date of a book's completion, inspiration. In his work on Proust, George Painter subtly let drop London, May 1959. And Richard Ellman introduced his Life of Joyce with Evanston, Illinois, March 15th. And in parentheses, my birthday, of the same year. Though generous, one might be excused for longing to know more. Where in London? What was the weather like in May 1959? Did the editor invite Painter out for lunch to celebrate Publication Day? Italian or French? And where on earth is Evanston, Illinois? Can one find drinkable coffee there? I mean, it's just silliness. And he is very good at sort of creating this world of this woman who he is dating, supposedly, although why she puts up with him, it's not very clear. Here's just one little more bit about how he's talking about this. This is in the kitchen biography section. Based solely on a consideration of the time taken up with ingesting it, food is to be counted as a significant part of any life. Isabel, this is the woman who's biography supposedly doing, Isabel spent 10 minutes eating breakfast, 20 snacking through lunch, and 45 munching dinner. A quarter of an hour a day was taken up with apples, nuts, crisps, and chocolate biscuits. She had therefore spent some 13,685 hours of her life in the process of eating, not to mention the time spent anticipating or regretting binges, something which probably brought the figure closer to 15,000 hours. And then he writes, but food rarely rears its head in works of biography. So it's just, it's great silliness. And he is just a great writer. Alain de Botton, Kiss and Tell. This is one of his earlier books. He went on to do a lot of writing about Proust, which is also very interesting. But this is the very funny one, Kiss and Tell.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jane.
So Samantha Irby is a 40-something-year-old writer who focused mainly on essays and TV writing. She's probably best known for being one of the lead writers on A.D. Bryant's comedy series Shrill, which is excellent if you haven't seen it. And she's had several collections of award-winning essays that she's published over the years. Wow, No Thank You, I think, is one of the more recent ones. And it's primarily about herself as a, you know, a 40-something-year-old Black woman kind of dealing with, you know, everything around us that is sort of not, not marketed at 40-year-old Black women. It's sort of, she's devastatingly funny, and she is hilariously adult. So a lot of it is, you've been warned, this is not safe for your kids or anybody else, really. But she, was able to find a radio friendly clip from one of her essays in this collection called Into the Gross. I think you'll quickly realize who she's sort of making fun of. I live for a glamorous lifestyle blog featuring some gorgeous ingenue with piles of secret wealth that she never divulges to the unsuspecting slobs on the other side of the screen. How does she afford $300 eye cream if her job is listed as freelance editor? And why is it so tossed so casually on her nightstand that she wouldn't cry if she lost it? I want to admire her floating through a bright and clean apartment in photos so beautiful and overexposed that it hurts your ugly, regular person eyes to look at, as she describes the minutiae of her daily routines, but all the cat dander clouding my eyes makes it difficult. Maybe I should try alkaline water, I murmur to myself as I squint through the unidentifiable goo on my dried phone screen, making a mental note to look up what adaptogens are after I search for the cheapest gratitude journal on Amazon. It just goes on and on like that. It's sort of like we're living in this world where we're expected to achieve these kind of high ideals that are completely unattainable. But the regular person is just sort of not able to do that. And she, despite the fact being a very successful person herself, she kind of portrays herself as kind of this slovenly, lazy, never leaving the house kind of person, which she clearly is not based on the success level of her work. But every essay in this is, it's hilarious, but it's full of language. So if that bothers you, that could be a problem.
Okay. Remind us of the title on that one.
The title is Wow, No Thank You by Samantha Irby.
All right, Jill.
All right. Well, I have in front of me Connie Willis's book, To Say Nothing of the Dog. And I just want to have a shout out to Dan Tridle, who apparently also loves this book. And I came across most recently, that when I was looking for books for this particular show, I came across this NPR 2019 100 Favorite Funny Books. And this is one of the books that is on there. And I have to say, it was actually put together by Petra Meyer, who we still miss. And she wrote on this, the news cycle is driving us to the edge of madness. So why not switch off, unplug, and pick up a book? We know you could use a laugh right now. And this is, I have to say, as true now as it was in 2019. And luckily, several thousand of you told us all about the books, stories, and poems that make you laugh. We took your votes, more than 7,000 of them, and with the help of our panel of expert judges, people so cool and so hilarious, I'm surprised they even talked to me, created this list of 100 reads designed to make you laugh out loud. And so one of the books on this list is To Say Nothing of the Dog. And this is what somebody wrote about it as part of this NPR What's the Funniest Book. If time travel really existed, it seems obvious that historians would have a go at it. Connie Willis imagined just that in To Say Nothing of the Dog, a romp between centuries that kicks off when a time-traveling Oxford researcher accidentally brings something back from the Victorian era, prompting a mad scramble to prevent the timeline from disruption. The title is a reference to Jerome K. Jerome's 1889 comic travelogue, Three Men in a Boat, To Say Nothing of the Dog, which you'll find in the classic section of this list. And yes, there is a boat and a thoroughly delightful dog. And I have to say, on top of that, Three Men in a Boat is one of my favorite books to read. And I, in fact, originally found it when I was a freshman in college. I don't know how it happened. And I had a friend who was living on the other side of the campus, and I would read her sections of this book every night over the phone. This was very much pre-internet. So, you know, you actually had to pick up a payphone to read this to somebody who's living on the other side. And what the NPR person wrote was, I did not intend to write a funny book at first, Jerome K. Jerome, and yes, that is his name, once said. Apparently, he intended this comic travelogue to be an actual travel guide for people considering boating expeditions along the Thames. But the characters based on Jerome and his friends quickly took over. We regret to inform you that Montmorency, the excellent dog, is entirely fictional, and Montmorency has a very big role in this book. Jerome made comic hay out of the most mundane things like weather, boats, and English food. Keep an eye out for the episode of the canned pineapple. So I recommend both To Say Nothing of the Dog by Connie Willis and Three Men in a Boat, To Say Nothing of the Dog by Jerome K. Jerome.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to tell us about a book that makes you laugh. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show, and our theme this month is funny books. With us are retired reference librarian Jill Erickson and Jane Iafredi, past chair of Falmouth Reads Together. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jane, what do you have for us next?
So next, I have one of the craziest books that I have read in recent times. The title is The Netanyahus, written by Joshua Cohen. And this is a highly, published in 2021, highly fictionalized account of Benzion Netanyahu, who is Benjamin Netanyahu's real-life father, arriving in upstate New York for an interview to be a professor at a fictionalized college. In real life, Ben Zion Netanyahu was a professor at Cornell for years. But this, again, this is a highly, highly fictionalized account of that job interview at the other college that is not Cornell. And it is so my wife read this and was laughing hysterically throughout it. And I was like, what the heck are you reading? I need to read this. And so I immediately did. And it is as solid gold as her recommendation was for it. I just read you a little bit from the start of the book. It'll give you a sense of it is a nutty, nutty book. Things happen in this book that you can't even imagine. And, you know, I'm like going through like Benjamin Netanyahu's biographies to try to figure out, is any of this true? Most of it is not. Which is good. So the start of The Netanyahus by Joshua Cohen. My name is Reuben Bloom. And yes, I'm an historian. Soon enough, though, I guess I'll be historical. By which I mean I'll die and become history myself in a rare type of transformation traditionally reserved for the purer scholars. Lawyers die and don't become the law. Doctors die and don't turn into medicine. But biology and chemistry professors pass away and decompose into biology and chemistry. As they mineralize into geology, they disperse into their science just as surely as mathematicians become statistics. The same process holds true for us historians. In my experience, we're the only ones in the humanities for whom this holds true. The only ones who become what we study. We age, we yellow, we go wrinkled and brittle along with our materials until our lives subside into the past and become the very substance of time. Or maybe that's just the Jew in me talking. Goys believe that the word believe in the word becoming flesh. The Jews believe in the flesh becoming word, a more natural, rational incarnation. It is a very funny book, and I laughed hysterically throughout this book because everything that could possibly go wrong for our poor protagonist, Reuben Bloom, does as the host of the Netanyahus during this one weekend of job interview. It's amazing, an amazing book.
The Netanyahus also is the title there. Yes. By Joshua Cohen. Jill.
So I was in the Boston Athenaeum a couple of weeks ago where I worked before I came to Falmouth Public Library. And I thought, you know, I'd like to see what humor was a long time ago, because they have lots of very old books on their shelves as well as very new books. And so I picked up this one book and it looks sort of interesting. It was a volume that's called The Tribune Primer by Eugene Field. Now, Eugene Field, many of you may know, possibly, that he was known best for the poem Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod. And you can actually, this book that I have in my hand, you can actually get to yourself if you go to the Internet Archive, which is archive.org. If you don't know about the Internet Archive, you should, because there are a lot of books that are out of print that are there. And what this book is, I still am not quite sure what this book is. He was a newspaper guy, and he wrote little bits for the newspapers. And I think that's what this must be, a collection of things he wrote for the newspapers, but it doesn't actually say that in the book. But here's some samplings. Here's a little bit on the lobster. This is not a big spider. It is a lobster. He is green now, but when he gets into hot water, he will look red and feel blue. The lobster carries his teeth on his arm. Pat him on the teeth. Maybe the teeth will kind of take to you. I mean, I don't know exactly what he was going for there, but I find it funny. But some of them are not as funny, and some of them are definitely very, very dated. Here's one on the billy goat. This strange-looking creature is a billy goat. He has a beard on him that looks like Papa's, and he is a stronger butter than Mama uses for cooking. What is the billy goat doing? He is eating an oyster can. If you were to go up and pull the billy goat's beard, you would feel something drop. And it would not be the billy goat either. Again, sort of hard to explain how I find these very funny, but also like incredibly dated. So it's a very interesting combo of reading these older books. And another one that I brought was The Funny Bone, which is New Humorous Stories designed by Cynthia Asquith. And I found this actual article that somebody had written about it more recently and who wrote... This week, I'm thinking about a 1928 British anthology of humorous short stories edited by Lady Cynthia Asquith. Daughter-in-law of the former Prime Minister, published originally under the title The Funny Bone, but my edition is titled New Tales of Humor. It contains 18 stories, mostly quite short, all of which are meant to be funny, and some of which actually achieve that ambition. Many, if not all, of these stories had appeared in the popular press before being collected here, presumably by the simple process of bourgeois scribblers being asked by an aristocrat to contribute a previously uncollected piece to her new anthology. But there are people in here that you've probably heard of and are probably the funniest of the bunch. P.G. Wodehouse, for example, has a story in here. E.F. Benson has a story. And L.P. Hartley, who any of you have watched on television or read the books, the Map and Lucia novels were done by L.P. Hartley. And Elizabeth Bone, who I wouldn't have thought would be in a comic group of stories necessarily, is in here as well. A dryly tart story about a girl plaguing a young curate is possibly the best thing in the book. So I think it's interesting to look at how things are written and how people look at things through humor from different decades. And a lot of it is not as funny as it once was, I would have to say. And a lot of it is about specific types of people, which are not very funny either. So it is an interesting thing to look at, though, and to remember we have indeed come a long way in terms of humor, although there's plenty of humor now that might not be for everyone as well. And maybe that is the thing about humor in general, is that it's not everybody finds everything funny.
Right.
And so, but one tries not to be offensive when one's funny, but it goes on all the time. So I don't know.
Right. That's the Tribune Primer by Eugene Field. Yes. And then the anthology you mentioned.
The Funny Bone.
Cynthia Asquith is the editor of that. All right. Jane.
So this is a book that I happened upon at a book sale. I had no idea that this was as famous a book or as much of a cult classic as it was when I picked it up. I picked it up when I was trying to read a lot about Afghanistan and Pakistan in the early 2000s when things were heating up there for the U.S. Military. The book is A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush by Eric Newby. It's published in 1958. Newby is a, at the time, he was working in fashion in London, and he had a friend in the Foreign Service named Hugh, and they decide they're going to go on a little jaunt up into the mountains in the Afghanistan-Pakistan area. Now, they decide that they're going to train for this in the hills of Wales. So as you can imagine, there is a magnitude of difference between the elevation of any hill in Wales and any tremendous mountain in the Hindu Kush, which, you know from the start that things are not going to be as they should go in this little expedition. A lot of reviewers call this the first modern piece of travel writing. People have also described it as one of the most British books ever written, because the humor is dry and witty, and it's nonstop. One passage, I think, sort of sums up the folly of this expedition for these two guys, which they survive. They do get through this. But Newby is describing how they were taking a rest day after, they drove as far as they could into one of these valleys in Afghanistan. And then They had to hike the rest of the way and camp the rest of the way. So they're at a camp and they're resting for the day. Hugh is reading The Hound of the Baskervilles, while Eric is trying to find what he describes as the only serious book on the expedition, which is a Bashgali Kafir language book to English, right? So he's starting to, this is the first time he's picked it up. It was buried at the bottom of a rice bag, and they were getting to the bottom of the rice bag, and he finds the book, which he's been looking for this whole expedition. And he starts reading passages out loud to Hugh, saying, shouldn't we be worried about some of the stuff? So I won't even attempt the Bashgali Kafir part of it, pronunciation, but the English translations are, if you've had diarrhea for many days, you surely will die. These are the important phrases to know in this part of the world. Don't drink much water, otherwise you won't be able to travel. And Hugh's like, I just want to read my book. Leave me alone with my Hound of the Baskervilles. I saw a corpse in the field this morning. Thy father fell into the river. I have 9 fingers. You have 10. And the best, I have an intention to kill you. To which came the reply in English, you are a very kind-hearted man. Anyways, this book is about adventure and misadventure, and as reviewers said, very British, very funny, and it's just a miracle that these guys get back to London in one piece, because this was a folly from the beginning. Anyways, that is A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush by Eric Newby.
And now we have Dave on the phone calling from Orleans. Hello, Dave.
Hi, everybody. I'll keep it very brief. I know you're at the end of the program here. A friend of mine gave me a book, and I can't recommend it highly enough in terms of the humorous books. It's called How to Be a Successful Contractor by Malcolm Wells. It is funny. It's just a picture book, pretty much, and it is full of all these goofs and gaffes at the silly things that you see contractors doing. And it just sort of pokes fun at people in there, in the trades. And it's just fun. I'm in the trades, and I love it.
That sounds great.
It's good to appreciate humor that pokes fun at oneself. So, and that sounds like one to check out for sure. Thank you very much, Dave from Orleans. Okay, Jill, what do you have next?
Well, I have one. I felt like I had to bring something with Edward Gorey in it, having worked with him in many shows and knowing that he lived on the Cape. And this one, it's actually what I love about it more than the writing is, in fact, his drawings. This is called Instant Lives and More by Howard Moss, but it's Edward's illustrations that really are great. It was reprinted by Godin Press. They reprint all kinds of great stuff. And as they describe it, a humor classic, fractured biographical moments from the lives of great writers and composers, loosely based on historical anecdotes. This is a collection of mostly imagined encounters between literary figures and their real or imagine family members, friends, and bitter enemies. In Howard Moss's satirical voice and Edward Gorey's 25 deadpan illustrations, we see Jane Austen wielding artful passive aggression and Sense and Sensibility galleys, the Alcott girls sculpting fudge, the rise of Emily Dickinson's ruthless witch hazel business, among other delights. Perfect for those who love literature too much to hold it closely to actual facts. And as I say, the illustrations themselves are always, I mean, anything that Edward illustrated was fabulous, but this one is particularly great. There is a whole section on Marcel Proust, for example. And the other people in here are Mozart is in here, and Franz Liszt, and T.E. Lawrence, James Joyce. And they're just little stories about all of these people who, and they're taken great fun of.
We will have a link to all of the books we've talked about today on our website a little bit later in the day, and you can find that at capeandislands.org. Our monthly book show is the last Wednesday of the month. Jane Iafrady and Jill Erickson, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jeanette Barnes, in for Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.